Welcome. This is the first lecture in our course on women in Indian Buddhism, done by the Numata Center of Buddhist Studies and the Women in Buddhism Studies Initiative at the University of Hamburg. And today, in this first lecture, I will look at a few selected passages from the early discourses that convey us something about the attitude towards women, and in particular towards nuns, as reflected in these discourses, and in particular by the reciters of these discourses. And the central discourse that I will be taking up is the Nandakovada Sutta. We have a version in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length discourse collection of the Theravada tradition preserved in Pali. But we also have parallel versions. And for those of you who may not have been here during previous courses of this e-learning type, I just wanted to briefly explain the significance of such parallel versions. The discourses that came into being at the time of the Buddha were passed on by oral transmission. And these oral transmission in different lineages spread all over India. And one of these transmission lineages reached Sri Lanka and became the Pali Canon. But we have other such transmission lineages, of which at times we have some Sanskrit fragments preserved in Central Asia, and in particular material preserved in Chinese translation, and at times also material preserved in Tibetan. And as these transmission lineages involve separate transmission, there is always the possibility that errors occur in only one version, but not in all of them. So there's the basic principle, we could say, that where the different versions, what they have in common, we can be fairly sure that this reflects a relatively early version of a discourse. And where they differ, then we have to evaluate through comparative study and contextualizing within the entire corpus of early discourses and even Vinayas to see which is probably the more earlier version and which is probably reflecting later developments. And our Nandakovada Sutta is a particularly good case to show this kind of methodology. So I begin by reading an excerpt here from the Pali version. And we are not so much concerned with the discourse itself, that is the teaching given in this discourse, which is very powerful, but we are more concerned in this comparison we are doing today with the narrative portion. In general, in my comparative studies, I've often found that the actual teaching is fairly similar, but major differences can occur in the narrative portions, in the part that the reciters themselves express their ideas and introduce what has happened. And this is more, it's almost like a commentary, we could say. At the very beginning stage, you would have had just a discourse itself, the actual teaching, and then the reciters would have explained, it happened at such and such a time, and such a thing led to this. And so these narrative portions would have been perceived at an early stage in the oral transmission as being more open to expressing also personal opinions or presentations. And it is particularly in such narrative portions that we can detect major differences. I think what I'm trying to present it will become more clear when we go on. So let us have a look at the introductory narration of the Nandakovada Sutta. then Mahaprajapati Gotami, together with 500 bhikkhunis, approached the Blessed One. Having approached and paid homage to the Blessed One, she stood to one side. Standing to one side, Mahaprajapati Gotami said this to the Blessed One. Venerable Sir, may the Blessed One instruct the bhikkhunis. Venerable Sir, may the Blessed One teach the bhikkhunis. Venerable Sir, may the Blessed One give the bhikkhunis a talk on the Dharma. At that time, the senior monks were taking turns at instructing the bhikkhunis. The Venerable Nandaka did not wish to take his turn at instructing the bhikkhunis. Then the Blessed One addressed Ananda. Ananda, whose turn is it now to instruct the bhikkhunis? Venerable Sir, in taking turns to teach the bhikkhunis, it is Nandaka's turn. Venerable Sir, the Venerable Nandaka does not wish to take his turn at teaching the bhikkhunis. Then the Blessed One addressed Ananda, the Venerable Nandaka. Nandaka, instruct the bhikkhunis. Nandaka, teach the bhikkhunis. Brahmin, give the bhikkhunis a talk on the Dharma. The Venerable Nandaka assented, it is well, Venerable Sir. Before turning to the Samyukta Agama parallel, I would like to give you a little bit of entertainment. There's a picture of Mahaprajapati Gotami and a group of bhikkhunis from a monastery in Bangkok. Now let us look at the same introductory narration in the Samyukta Agama parallel. At that time, in the Raja Karama at Savati, there were various great disciples from the community of bhikkhunis. With bhikkhunis from the community of bhikkhunis by the name of Bhikkhuni Chanda, Bhikkhuni Minto, Bhikkhuni Molopo, Bhikkhuni Patachara, Bhikkhuni Alavika, Bhikkhuni Kima, Bhikkhuni Nanmo, Bhikkhuni Kisa Gotami, Bhikkhuni Uppalavanna, and Bhikkhuni Mahaprajapati Gotami. I just need to explain that a few of these names in the Chinese, I have not been able to determine the Indic original. This is why we have just the Mintuo, Molopo, these kind of Chinese sounding names. I just don't know what the original name would have been that underlies the translation or transcription there. I continue. At that time, the bhikkhuni Mahaprajapati Gotami, surrounded by 500 bhikkhunis, approached the Buddha, paid respect with her head at his feet, and withdrew to sit to one side. Then the Blessed One taught the Dharma to Mahaprajapati Gotami and the other bhikkhunis, instructing, teaching, illuminating, and delighting them. Having in various ways taught them the Dharma, instructed, taught, illuminated, and delighted them, he gave them leave to return by saying, "Bhikkhunis, it is the proper time for you to leave." Hearing what the Buddha had said, the bhikkhuni Mahaprajapati Gotami and the other bhikkhunis were delighted and rejoiced in it, paid respect and left. When the Blessed One knew that the bhikkhuni Mahaprajapati Gotami and the other bhikkhunis had left, he addressed the monks. "I have become old. I am no longer able to teach the Dharma to the bhikkhunis. From now on, those of you in the community of monks who are senior virtuous elders should give instructions to the bhikkhunis." Then the monks, on receiving the Blessed One's instruction, took turns in giving instructions to the bhikkhunis, until it was Nandaka's turn. Then Nandaka did not want to give them instructions, even though it was his proper turn. Then the bhikkhuni Mahaprajapati Gotami, surrounded by 500 bhikkhunis, approached the Buddha, paid respect with the head at his feet, etc. They were delighted and rejoiced in hearing the Dharma, paid respect, and left. When the Blessed One knew that the Bhikkhuni Mahaprajapati Kotami had left, he asked the Venerable Ananda, "Whose turn is it to give instructions to the Bhikkhunis?" The Venerable Ananda said to the Buddha, "Blessed One, the elders have been taking turns in giving instructions to the Bhikkhunis until Nandaka's turn has come. Yet Nandaka does not want to give them instructions." Then the Blessed One said to Nandaka, "You should give instructions to the Bhikkhunis. You should teach the Dharma to the Bhikkhunis. Why is that? I myself give instructions to the Bhikkhunis, so you should also do it. I teach the Dharma to the Bhikkhunis, so you should also do it." At that time, Nandaka silently accepted the instruction. So, after having had a first reading, I would like to return. And in the light of this other version, just go through some key points, key differences that we find between these two narrative introductions to what is the same discourse. The first difference that we notice is that in the Pali version, we are just told that Mahaprajapati Gotami and 500 bhikkhunis approached the Blessed One. But in the Samyukta Agama, these bhikkhunis are qualified as great outstanding disciples, and they are also introduced by name, which is a considerably more respectful way of introducing them and gives more nuance or conveys their importance. Then we find that when Mahaprajapati Gotami has reached the Blessed One, she stands to one side. In the Samyukta Agama version, she sits down. And this is quite significant. I mean, this is, one might think, well, what's the difference? She's standing, she's sitting. But the depiction of the posture adopted by someone in the discourses acts as a signifier in the presentation of this particular person and what function he or she has. And in the elsewhere in the Majjhima Nikaya, if we check for other instances, we find that those, if a disciple comes to visit the Buddha, they will always sit down. But if it's somebody who just gives a message, or if it's somebody who has come to challenge the Buddha, that is not a disciple, but somebody from who is not a Buddhist disciple and he is coming to debate with the Buddha, they will stand. So this, in itself, rather minor difference, whether somebody is sitting down or standing, is part of, it already gives a slight underlying different message. If Mahaprajapati Gotami doesn't sit down, she stands. It gives to those who are familiar with the Majjhima Nikaya, it gives a slight nuance as if there's something not quite right with what she's doing there. One gets the feeling that, is she challenging the Buddha or what's happening? Just because of this in itself rather unimportant small detail. Then, and this is, I think, particularly strong here, we get Mahaprajapati three times asked the Buddha to give a teaching. May the Blessed One instruct the bhikkhunis, teach the bhikkhunis, give the bhikkhunis a talk on the Dharma. This is another standard mode of procedure in the discourses, that a request will be made up to three times. The difference here is that it goes all in, she does it all in one, but usually there is like one makes one request and the Buddha might refute that, and one makes a second request and the Buddha might again refuse that, but when there is a third request, it's sort of like then the Buddha will kind of access to that request. He will do what is being requested if that is at all possible. So this pattern does not fully fit the present case because there is no intervening reply by the Buddha. But nevertheless, for the Buddha as the compassionate teacher of mankind, to be asked three times to give a teaching, and he just doesn't give a teaching, gives a very, very strong impression. The next difference is that we are just told that the monks were taking turns at instructing the bhikkhunis. Here in the Samyukta Agama version, and we have also the same in the Mula Savastivada Vinaya, we get a more detailed explanation why the Buddha is getting old. And he's asking the monks to take over the duty on his part, which is something that invests the teaching of the bhikkhunis with an air of honor. The next thing here then, the Buddha, on being asked three times to teach the Dharma to the bhikkhunis, he doesn't even reply to them. If we imagine that scene, Mahapajapati Gautama is there with the bhikkhunis, Bhante, can you give us a teaching? And he just turns around and talks to Ananda as if they're not even there. Kind of gives them a cold shoulder. And then, right in front of them, he asks them, who is the one to teach the bhikkhunis? This again gives a very strong impression compared to the Samyukta Agama version and also the Mula Savastivada Vinaya. And then, when the Buddha talks to Nanaka, he uses the same terminology. If you look at the passage up here where Mahapajapati Gautami asks, he's asked, instruct, teach, give the bhikkhunis a talk on the Dharma. And the Buddha just says the same to Nanaka. Instruct the bhikkhunis, teach the bhikkhunis, give them a talk on the Dharma. So we get this feeling that, like he's being asked to teach, he doesn't even reply, he just turns around and passes the task off to someone else. And then, particularly noteworthy is that in the Pali version, the Buddha calls Nanaka a Brahmin. Now, according to the Appadana, Nanaka was not a Brahmin by birth. So the use of the term Brahmin here is a laudatory term. And this is particularly puzzling because Nanaka has actually not taken his turn. It was his turn to do something, and he has just not done it. And then he's even being lauded for that by saying, oh, Brahmin. And normally in the Majjhima Nikaya elsewhere, when someone is being rebuked, they will remain silent. We even get this description, how they sit like shoulders looping, head down. But here, Nanaka answers, yes, it's well, Venerable Sir. And this, again, this form of answering is normally a way that happens when a disciple is in a question and answer exchange with the Buddha, but not when somebody is being rebuked. So this combination of the term Brahmin and then Venerable Nanaka giving an explicit reply really does not give the impression as if he is being taken to task for something that he has not done. But for him not to take his turn at teaching the nuns is not a particularly praiseworthy action. In fact, according to the Pali Vinaya, a monk who does not take his turn at instructing the nuns incurs an offense of wrongdoing, a dukkata. So if we put all these smaller details together, we see that this introduction narration in the Pali version has a number of negative elements. And this really stands in contrast to the Samyukta Agama version. As we can see here again, the nuns are introduced by name, various great disciples, and the same is also the case for the Mula Savastivada Vinaya. And then, you see here she sits down. Mahapajapati sits down. And she hasn't even asked for a teaching. The first thing she sits down, the Buddha gives her a teaching, which is like natural. A disciple comes, the Buddha will give them a talk on the Dharma. And so they get this teaching and they leave. And it is only after that that the issue of instructing the nuns comes up explicitly, and here the Buddha explains, he gives a reason for passing on the task of teaching the bhikkhunis to the monks. He explains that he's old and he's not able to continue teaching in this way. according to the Mula Savastivada Vinaya version, the Buddha not only speaks of teaching the bhikkhunis, but of speaks of teaching all four assemblies, which is the monks, nuns, male and female lay followers. And so this gives a kind of context that makes it a very honorable task to teach the bhikkhunis, because in this way one takes over a duty earlier performed by the Buddha himself, and one also shows one's compassionate concern for the Buddha's old age. And then Bhikkhuni Mahaprajapati and her followers come again. And the abbreviation up to means that the same thing is happening again. So again, the Buddha just gives them a talk on the Dharma. So in this way, in the Samyukta Agama and in the Mula Savastivada Vinaya, on twice the Bhikkhunis and Mahaprajapati get a full teaching from the Buddha. Whereas in the Pali version, even after a triple request, no teaching from the Buddha is given at all. And then in the next passage, we find that the Buddha knew, when he knew that Bhikkhuni Mahaprajapati Gautam has left, he asked whose turn is it to give instruction to the Bhikkhunis. This is again a very polite way of acting, which I am quite familiar to in general from living in Asia, where we always try to avoid discussing embarrassing issues in front of those people who are involved in it. So, I mean, of course, Mahaprajapati and the Bhikkhunis, when they come the second time here in the Samyukta Agama, they would have been aware of the fact that someone has not taken his turn at giving the teachings. But nevertheless, it's a very polite way of dealing with the situation to wait until they have gone, excuse me, and then discuss among, find out like who has not taken his turn. And this is a particularly strong contrast to the Pali version, where the Buddha kind of ignores that they are there, doesn't even reply to them, and then just in front of them asks like who has not been giving them teachings. And then here the Buddha tells him not only to give instructions, but he also sets himself as an example. He says, I myself give instructions, you should also do it. And Nanaka remains silent, which is, as I mentioned before, the appropriate description for a type of reaction when somebody is being rebuked. So if we summarize the main points that emerge from the comparative study of these introductory narrations, and after the summary there will be time for you to make any comment or questions in the chat, we find that in the Nandakovada Sutta, the bhikkhunis are not introduced by name, and they are also not qualified as great disciples. Mahaprajapati Gautami remains standing instead of sitting down. The Buddha does not teach the bhikkhunis in spite of their request. The discourse does not explain why the monks should teach the bhikkhunis. The Buddha in fact ignores the presence of the bhikkhunis. And he just passes on Gautami's request to Nandaka. Nandaka is lauded as a Brahmin and replies as if nothing has happened. The last point belongs to the next section. When he arrives, the bhikkhunis act as respectful as if he were the Buddha. This is a section that I have not taken up fully in the paper, I think. Let me just check. Yeah, this is a passage I am not giving in full, but when Nandaka arrives to give this actual teaching, the bhikkhunis not only prepare a seat for him, but they also set out water for washing the feet. And again, these small details are in themselves, of course, totally innocent. In ancient India, they were often walking around barefoot. The road is dusty, so it is a natural thing when somebody comes that one sets out water for washing the feet. But it is another question whether such a action is explicitly mentioned by the reciters of the discourse. And elsewhere in the Majjhima Nikaya, we find that this action of setting out water for washing the feet is something that is being done towards the Buddha only. So for the Nandakovada to show the bhikkhunis setting out water when Nandaka arrives puts him at so high a position compared to them as if he were similar to the Buddha. So, and here's the Samyukta Agama version summarized. The bhikkhunis are introduced by name and as great disciples. Mahapajapati sits down. And without even being asked to do so, the Buddha twice gives them a teaching. And because of his old age, the Buddha asks the monks to teach the bhikkhunis. And he waits until they have left to inquire who has not taken his turn. Excuse me. By teaching the bhikkhunis, Nandaka would follow the Buddha's example. Nandaka remains silent, which is in line with his having failed to do his duty. And when Nandaka arrives in the Samyukta Agama, the bhikkhunis politely welcome him, but they do not set out water for washing the feet. So I think if we take these differences and compare them, we can see that in the Pali version, the Theravada version, there is a continuous tendency to express a more negative attitude towards bhikkhunis. And this is, I think, quite significant. And there is a second part of the discourse towards the end, which describes the attainments of the bhikkhunis, where the same tendency can be seen. But before going on to that second part, I would like to open the time for you to have any question or comment you would like to make on the presentation so far. Silence. This is the place to make any comment or question. Good, then I just move on. Now we come to the next part, which describes the attainments of the bhikkhunis. What they reached after the very powerful instruction given by Venerable Nandaka. So I will read the Nandakovada Sutta. Then the Venerable Nandaka, having instructed the bhikkhunis with this instruction, dismissed them, saying, "Go, sisters, it is time." Then the bhikkhunis, having delighted and rejoiced in what the Venerable Nandaka had said, rose from their seats and paid homage, keeping him to their right, and approached the Blessed One. Having approached the Blessed One and paid their homage to him, they stood to one side. The Blessed One said to the bhikkhunis, who were standing to one side, "Go, sisters, it is time." Then the bhikkhunis paid homage to the Blessed One and, keeping him to their right, left. Soon after the bhikkhunis had left, the Blessed One addressed the monks. "Monks, it is just as if on the observance day, the 14th, people have no doubt or uncertainty. Is the moon not yet full, or is the moon full? Since the moon is not yet full." In the same way, monks, the bhikkhunis are delighted with the Dharma teaching of Nandaka, but their aspirations have not been fulfilled. Then the Blessed One addressed Nandaka. "Well then, Nandaka, tomorrow you should instruct the bhikkhunis with the same instruction." The Venerable Nandaka assented, "It is well, Venerable Sir." Now I have put a party in italics to abbreviate. So just as previously, Nanda goes begging in the morning and then he approaches the nunnery to deliver the same talk to the bhikkhunis. And after that talk, we continue. Then the Venerable Nandaka, having instructed the bhikkhunis with this instruction, dismissed them saying, "Go, sisters, it is time." Then the bhikkhunis, having delighted and rejoiced in what the Venerable Nandaka had said, rose from their seats and paid homage, keeping him to their right, and approached the Blessed One. Having approached the Blessed One and paid their homage to him, they stood to one side. The Blessed One said to the bhikkhunis, who were standing to one side, "Go, sisters, it is time." Then the bhikkhunis paid homage to the Blessed One and, keeping him to their right, left. Soon after the bhikkhunis had left, the Blessed One addressed the monks. "Monks, it is just as if on the observance day, the 15th, people have no doubt or uncertainty. Is the moon not yet full, or is the moon full? Since the moon is full." In the same way, monks, the bhikkhunis are delighted with the Dhamma teaching of Nandaka and their aspirations have been fulfilled. Monks, even the most backward of the 500 bhikkhunis, is a stream enterer, no longer subject to downfall, certain to proceed to full awakening. So far the Pali version. Now let us see what we have in the Samyukta Ayama. At that time, the Venerable Nandaka taught the Dharma to the bhikkhunis, instructing, teaching, illuminating, and delighting them. Having instructed, taught, illuminated, and delighted them, he rose from his seat and left. Then the bhikkhuni Mahapajapati Gotami, surrounded by 500 bhikkhunis, approached the Buddha, paid respect with her head at his feet, and sat back to one side. She paid respect to the Buddha and left. When the Blessed One knew that the bhikkhuni Mahapajapati Gotami and the other bhikkhunis had left, he said to the monks, "It is just as when various people look at the bright moon on the night of the 14th day, thinking, 'Is it full or is it not yet full?' One should know that the moon is not really full. In the same way, the clansman Nandaka has given proper instructions to the 500 bhikkhunis, properly taught them the Dharma, yet the liberation is not really full. Excuse me. However, if it were the time for passing away for those bhikkhunis, I do not see a single fetter that they have not eliminated, due to which they would be reborn in this world." Oops. That was not intended. Then the Blessed One said to Nandaka, "You should teach the Dharma to the bhikkhunis again." Then the Venerable Nandaka silently accepted the injunction. Again, I am abbreviating here, so the discourse continues with the same description as earlier, given in partially abbreviated manner, of Nandaka's going begging in the morning and then approaching the nunnery to deliver a talk to the bhikkhunis. At the end of this talk, we continue. Nandaka taught the Dharma to the bhikkhunis, instructing, teaching, illuminating, and delighting them. Having instructed, taught, illuminated, and delighted them, he rose from his seat and left. At a subsequent time, the bhikkhuni Mahapajapati Gotami, surrounded by 500 bhikkhunis, approached the Buddha, paid respect with the head at his feet, and sat back to one side. She paid respect to the Buddha and left. When the Blessed One knew that the bhikkhuni Mahapajapati Gotami and the other bhikkhunis had left, he said to the monks, "It is just as when people look at the bright moon on the night of the 15th day and have no doubt whether it is full or not full, since the moon is completely full. In the same way, the clansman Nandaka has given proper instructions to the 500 bhikkhunis. The liberation is complete. If it were the time for passing away for them, nobody could proclaim the course of their destination. It should be known that they reached the end of dukkha." In this way, the Blessed One conferred on the 500 bhikkhunis a declaration of the supreme fruit. So here we see again substantial differences in the way how the effect of this talk by Nandaka on the bhikkhunis is being described. In the Pali version, after the first teaching, no attainment of the bhikkhunis is reported. And then, and I just go back to the place where this is being said in the Pali version, particularly significant. Tomorrow you should instruct the bhikkhunis with the same instruction. It means Nandaka is being told to just repeat the same thing once again. Now, repetition in an oral situation has its functions, much more so than we are nowadays used to, especially if a discourse is given in a meditative manner. It can be very helpful to just say the same thing once more and really let it sink into the mind. Nevertheless, combined with the fact that in the Pali version, none of the nuns has reached any kind of attainment, the fact that the Buddha then explicitly tells Nandaka give them the same instruction gives really a little, could give the impression that the nuns are a little bit slow, that they didn't really understand or process it properly, and they need to be told the same thing again. This is not the case in the Samyukta Agama version, where there's no explicit indication by the Buddha that he should say the same. It just says you should teach the Dharma to the bhikkhunis again. But this is a general statement, and in the part that I have not given in full, there's also no indication that Nandaka should teach exactly the same thing. And the same also holds for the parallel versions. Yeah, and with the second teaching, then some bhikkhunis only reach stream entry. Here's the statement again. Even the most backward of the 500 bhikkhunis is a stream enterer. Now, if you look at the Samyukta Agama version, already with the first teaching, the bhikkhunis have reached non-return, which is a much higher attainment, of course, than stream entry. And as I already mentioned, the second teaching is a general talk on the Dharma, not necessarily a repetition. And with the second teaching, the bhikkhunis all reach full awakening. So their outcome of this teaching and the abilities of bhikkhunis to reach awakening is substantially different. Excuse me. Now, when faced with such differences, of course, we would like to know which is the earlier version, no? Because the fact that Samyukta Agama and the Mula Savastivada Vinaya agree is not so powerful in this case, because they come from the same tradition, from the same Buddhist school. As far as we are able to determine, the Samyukta Agama preserved in Chinese translation as Taisho entry number 99, which is the discourse we are discussing here as part of that, also was transmitted within the Mula Savastivada tradition. So for a Mula Savastivada discourse and a Mula Savastivada Vinaya to agree, it means just that one recited tradition sees it in this way and the other recited tradition, which we have in the Theravada Pali version, presents it differently. But now, when we further explore this, it's interesting that Pali commentaries, the Theragata, Terigata and Anguttara Nikaya, also report that all of the nuns had become arahants at the end of this instruction. But this does not mean that the idea that the nuns became all arahants is later. Might be the first conclusion one would draw, because one would say, well, it's not in the sutta and only in the commentaries, so it must be later. Because the commentary on the Majjhima Nikaya, Papanchasudani, reports that they did not reach full awakening. So there's a discrepancy here within the same commentarial tradition. And if we imagine this, if we examine this difference in relation to the simile of the full moon, then, and let me just return to this place, the image of the moon being full in the Pali version illustrates that the aspirations of the bhikkhunis have been fulfilled. In the Samyukta Agama version, it illustrates the attainment of full awakening. And this is a subtle but important difference. And elsewhere in Pali discourses, in Sutta Nipata 637 and Dhammapada 413, the full moon stands for full awakening, not for any type of aspiration. And it is also a little strange that according to the Pali version, some of the bhikkhunis then becoming stream enterer, having their aspirations fulfilled, means that from the outset they only aspire to stream entry. In fact, I'm not aware of any passage that would support this type of idea. That, of course, particularly in the Vinaya, we find sometimes monks, maybe also nuns, going forth for worldly motives, but that those who sincerely aspire to awakening, would from the outset only aspire to stream entry, is something with which I'm not at all familiar. So this presentation in the Pali version that some of the bhikkhunis from the outset aspired only to stream entry seems rather strange. And the Samyukta Agama version, where the simile of the full moon does not illustrate the aspiration, much rather the full awakening of the nuns, is much more in line with what this simile generally conveys. Now there's one other point that is quite significant, and let me go back again here to the beginning of the Nandakovada Sutta's passage. The Venerable Nandaka, having instructed the bhikkhunis with this instruction, dismissed them, saying, "Go, sisters, it is time." This creates an internal inconsistency in the Nandakovada, because Nandaka has gone to the nunnery. There's no way for him to tell the sisters to go, but he is the one who has to go. And this is, in fact, what he does in the parallel versions. And this internal inconsistency within the discourse can be explained by the Paccitiya 23 in the Theravada Vinaya, according to which at a certain time there was a problem about monks setting themselves up as teachers of nuns, and from then on this rule was promulgated that the nuns should come to the monastery of the monks to get these teachings, so that monks who were not really capable of giving such teachings, that there could be some kind of control over this. The Nandakovada Sutta itself clearly stems from a time before this rule was set up, because in agreement with its parallels, it describes that Venerable Nandaka went to the nunnery to give the teaching. So this passage here, where Nandaka dismisses them and saying, "Go, sisters," it must be a later development. It must be a change in the discourse reflected by the understanding of the reciters who were familiar with the regulation Paccitiya 23, and who were therefore, for them, it was natural to formulate this passage in such a way to which they would have been familiar and accustomed to from their own experience when nuns were always coming to the monastery of monks. So I think if we take the full moon simile and the fact of the dismissing of the nuns together, we can draw the conclusion that the Nandakovada Sutta's presentation is the later version. That the negative portrayal of the nuns in the Nandakovada Sutta clearly reflects later development, and that the Samyukta Agama together with the Mula Savastivada Vinaya reflect an earlier version that is much more accommodating towards the nuns, much more positive, that presents them as great disciples, presents them by name, no distancing, no ignoring of the nuns by the Buddha, and in particularly capable of reaching highest attainment. This is as far as what I had to on the Nandakovara Sutta. And again, time for any questions or comments if you wish. While some of the participants are writing questions, I just want to mention that this distancing of bhikkhunis that we quote Sli in the Nannakovara Sutta is also a trait in the Theravada Vinaya. In the Theravada Vinaya, the direct contacts between Mahaprajapati Gotami and the Buddha are much less compared to other Vinayas. So there is a kind of a trend, excuse me, in the Theravada recital tradition to distance none, to portray them as something that the Buddha would keep at a distance, that they don't have direct access to the Buddha. And this is much stronger than in other Vinaya traditions. But this does not mean that the Theravadins are always the bad ones, and we will see some passages where this is not so bad, but it is a tendency found in all Buddhist traditions to diminish the abilities and attainments of nuns, to distance them. And this reflects, obviously, the attitude of the reciters. How much confidence can we place in that conclusion that the SR version is early? Is it just quite likely or very likely? I would opt for very likely. There's so much this internal inconsistency, the full moon simile, and also the support from the Pali commentary tradition, and then this problem of Nandaka leaving. Coming to the nunnery and then telling them to go together, I think this is very strong evidence, and I would firmly put my feet on the ground and say yes. Samyukta Agama Mula Savasivadavane is the earlier version. Venerable, thank you so much for the teaching. I would like to ask the point about the time of recension of MN 146 as you observed. You observed the tendency of the Majjhima Nikaya to have a more negative portrayal of nuns in the Majjhima Nikaya. Does it reveal to us anything about the closing time of the recension of the Majjhima Nikaya? At what historical period would you suggest the sutta have been finally edited? Thank you so much for your inspiring teachings. I think that these changes would have happened at a relatively early time. The dating of the Majjhima Nikaya's closure is a disputed point, and some scholars have moved this as far forward as the time of Buddha Gosa, the commentator, the great commentator in the Pali tradition, assuming that the suttas only reach their final form when they are kind of been fixed by the commentaries. But in a paper entitled The Historical Value of the Pali Discourses, which I think I could try to make available on the forum for those of you interested, I have argued against that. And my personal feeling is that the closure time for the Pali Discourses would be around the time of King Ashoka, and not much later. And the Samyukta Agama was transmitted by oral transmission, then as a manuscript, apparently found in Sri Lanka, interestingly, by Fa Xian, the Chinese pilgrim, at Abhayagiri, which at that time was a monastery that had lively contacts with various Buddhist schools in India, and brought back to China and then translated in China. And that would have been in the much, much later than the closure time of the Majjhima Nikaya. But the time of translation of a text does not give us the time of closure of the text. And I would expect that the Samyukta Agama that we have now in Chinese translation also, excuse me, similar to the Majjhima Nikaya, reflects about the developments of the first two maximum three centuries in Buddhist thought. So I would put them in terms of closure time, I would put them roughly at the same level. The moon simile makes more sense in the Samyukta version because it represents the difference between non-return and arahantship, 4th and 15th day. The image makes less sense if it corresponds to a range of attainment starting with stream entry. Very good point. Very good point. I had noticed that. I have to note that down. Actually true, yeah. The 14th and the 15th days really reflects that short, well, that because stream entry and one's return, and then from one's return to non-return is a considerable advance, and non-return and arahantship are often mentioned together. While they are, of course, different, they often come as a group, even at the conclusion of Satipatthana Sutta. We have this Diteva Dhamme Anya Sativa Upadisesya Anagamita, so that the mindfulness practice described in Satipatthana Sutta is shown as being capable of reaching, leading to non-returned arahantship. So this recurrent mentioning together of non-returned arahantship really fits the idea of the almost full moon and the completely full moon. Very good point. Good, then thank you so much for the comments and questions. And then we have a look at Mara. So before going to a passage that involves Mara, I wanted to just quote, this is just from Stephen Batchelor, but other scholars have also made similar suggestions. So Stephen Batchelor suggests that Mara is a metaphoric way of describing Buddha's own inner life. Mara's tireless efforts to undermine Buddha by accusing him of insincerity, self-deception, are ways of describing the doubts within Buddha's own mind. So according to Stephen Batchelor, the function of Mara in early Buddhist discourses is to reflect one's own defilements, in this case of the Buddha. And this then leads to the conclusion that even the Buddha was not really fully purified, but he had these problems, he had doubts, and so Mara acts these out. And in a paper on the Bhikkhunis and Mara published in a book by Alice Collette, I have argued against that, and there are some instances that simply don't fit this type of interpretation. One is here, Samyutta Nikaya 416, and it's Samyukta Agama parallel. And here we have the story that Mara changes himself into an ox and then comes close to the begging bowls of monks. And these monks are just listening to a discourse by the Buddha. So while the Buddha is teaching, Mara wants to distract them from listening to the Buddha. So he walks like close to these begging bowls. And then the monks are kind of like, oh my God. Because they would have had these clay begging bowls, and if that ox breaks them, then they have problems going begging the next morning. It's kind of hard to see how this could be an exemplification of inner defilements. And another one is Majjhima Nikaya 50, and it's three parallels. And this is a story situated at a time in the past with a past Buddha. And here Mara causes an arahant monk, this is one of the two chief disciples of that past Buddha, to be hit on the head so that the head starts bleeding. Again, it's a little hard to see how this could be, excuse me again, an exemplification of living out of inner defilements. So what I propose is that the didactic function of Mara in early Buddhist discourses is not confined to acting out inner defilements, but sometimes can simply be a way of portraying challenges from the outside and showing to in what way a disciple of the Buddha should handle such challenges. In this verse, the arahant monk just silently bears up with the pain. So I conclude, Mara is not just a personification of one's own defilements, but in the early discourses can also just function as a personification of challenges by outsiders or difficult circumstances. And this, against this background, I would now like to turn to a discourse on Soma. This is part of a set of 10 discourses in the Bhikkhuni Samyutta and parallel in the two Samyukta Agamas that we have preserved. One, the one we will be looking at now, is Samyukta Agama Taisho entry number 99, a complete Samyukta Agama. The other one where I have this SA and then this little 2 in hyperscript is Samyukta Agama is Taisho number 100, is an incomplete Samyukta Agama translation, which is being studied and partially translated by a colleague of mine, Markus Bingenheimer. But this one is the version from the complete one, and I will read the discourse. Mara transformed himself into a youth of handsome appearance and went to the Bhikkhuni Soma. He said to the Bhikkhuni, "Lady, where do you want to go?" The Bhikkhuni replied, "Friend, I am going to a secluded place." Then Mara, the evil one, spoke in verse. "The state wherein seers dwell, this state is very difficult to attain. One with just a 2 fingers wisdom is unable to attain that state. Just as an aside, as far as I'm able to determine, this idea of 2 fingers wisdom is an allusion to the way rice was being cooked in ancient India, where they apparently used the 2 fingers to test if the rice was already cooked or not. So it's a kind of derogatory statement towards women, that they are about intelligent enough to know if rice is being cooked with their 2 fingers, but they can't get much more." And continue with the discourse. Then the Bhikkhuni Soma thought, "Who is this wanting to frighten me? Is he a human or is he a non-human? Is this person scheming to seduce me?" Having considered it, certainty of knowledge arose in her, and she knew, "This is the evil Mara who has come wanting to confound me." She spoke in verse. "Once the mind has entered a meditative attainment, what has a female appearance to do with that? If knowledge has arisen, the unsurpassable state will be reached. But if the mind has not reached complete separation from the perception of being a man or a woman, then such a one will speak like you, Mara. You should go and speak to such a one. Separated from all dukkha, having entirely relinquished the darkness of ignorance, having attained and realized cessation, I dwell in peace, established in the eradication of the influxes. I recognize you, evil Mara. Make yourself disappear and go." Then Mara, the evil one, thought, "The Bhikkhuni Soma has understood my intention." Harboring sadness and regret within, he vanished and was seen no more. I think this, and also the passage to which I'm going to come after, are meant to counterbalance the negative impressions that we saw in the Nandakovada Sutta by also showing passages that portray nuns in a positive light. And I just want to note that her affirmation here that she's established in the eradication of the influxes confirms my suggestion that Mara cannot be acting out inner defilements, because his remark that only a woman has only this 2 fingers wisdom could not be reflecting a thought arising in Soma's own mind. She has already reached arahantship. How could she have any doubt about the wisdom a woman can reach? So this is clearly a portrayal of opinions prevalent in the ancient Indian setting. And she shows the way of replying to them. And I find it particularly interesting that this derogatory remark that a woman has only 2 fingers wisdom, this putting in question the ability of women to be wise, is the only such instance I'm aware of in the corpus of the early discourses. There's this statement that a woman cannot be a Buddha. But as I have tried to explain in a study of the Bahudhātuka Sutta where this statement occurs, this is not at the stage of early Buddhism. The idea, the bodhisattva ideal had not yet arisen. This is a later development. So the statement that a woman cannot fulfill the role of a Buddha is not a question of wisdom and ability to awaken, but much rather reflects the ancient Indian setting where a woman could not take the leader role, a leadership role. In fact, the inability of a woman to be a Buddha comes together with the inability of a woman to be a universal monarch, a Chakravarti Raja. But here, Mara's remark, woman with her two fingers wisdom, is clearly saying women are, I mean, saying it very flatly, women are just too silly. They cannot be wise. And the fact that this idea is put into the mouth of Mara then shows that from the viewpoint of the early Buddha's reciters, this kind of idea could only be the work of Mara. And the discourse is meant to provide other nuns with an example on how such prejudices should be confronted. And she simply says that when you're an arahant, this whole distinction between man or woman is no longer relevant. So with this kind of prejudice, you better go to those who are still identified with being a man or a woman. Before I get into the next one, I want to see again if there's any kind of question or remark about this passage and what I said about Mara. This pattern is, I see somebody is giving a question, so I just talk a little bit until that question comes. This pattern of the bhikkhuni recognizing Mara is a consistent trait throughout the bhikkhuni samyutta. And it is interesting to contrast this with the Mara samyutta, where Mara comes to challenge bhikkhus and they do not recognize him. The fact of recognition has to do with the level of awakening. It seems that as far as we are able to determine, only arahants are able to recognize Mara fully. Nevertheless, the fact that these 10 bhikkhunis are all shown to recognize Mara, just tell them to, you get off here. Whereas the times when he challenges bhikkhus, they have to be told by the Buddha, hey, you know, this is the work of Mara, is an instance that also shows that the negative attitude towards nuns that we were able to identify in the Nandakovara Sutta is not a consistent trait throughout the early discourses, but that we have different, what I would call, a multivocality in the early discourses. And sometimes there are passages like the present one who very strongly affirm the ability, agency, and potential of women. I remember reading some passages in Samyutta Nikaya where Mara is described as an inner voice of bhikkhunis questioning the value of their practice. It would make sense to me that Mara could be synonymous for any distraction and hindering factors on the path, be they external or internal. Yeah, this was, I was not intending, thank you for pointing this, I was not intending to completely dismiss the idea of Mara being an exemplification of internal problems. I was only trying to show that this cannot be the default explanation, because there are several instances for this which this does not work, and it also would not work in the present case, because Soma, having become an arahant, could not have any doubt about women's wisdom. So Mara's remark, let us just go back to the remark again that Mara makes. The state wherein seers dwell, the state is difficult to attain. One with just the two fingers wisdom is unable to attain that state. The assumption that the state wherein seers dwell is liberation, arahantship, that a woman, because of her two fingers wisdom, cannot attain that, this type of doubt could not arise in someone who has reached that state already. And Soma clearly has. So in this instance, and also in the other two passages I mentioned earlier, it is not possible that Mara is acting out inner uncertainties. But thank you for helping me to clarify this. Yeah, then I'm going on, and this will be the last passage we are looking at, the listing of outstanding bhikkhunis in the Etaragavagga of Anguttara Nikaya and its Ekottarika Agama parallel. As a part of the Anguttara Nikaya, where of each of the four assemblies, bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, male and female lay followers, a certain members are singled out for being outstanding, exemplary. And in the Anguttara Nikaya, we have 13 bhikkhunis who are singled out. In the Ekottarika Agama, we have 51. And the ratio for bhikkhus is somewhat less, where in Anguttara Nikaya, we have 41, and in Ekottarika Agama, 101 bhikkhus. So the Ekottarika Agama in general has more members for each of these categories, but in the case of bhikkhunis, is particularly pronounced the difference that it presents 51 bhikkhunis by name, outstanding for a particular quality. And because that text is a little bit too compact to put into this lecture, I have summarized the different abilities, put them under four different headers, and instead of giving the names of the nuns, where again sometimes there is the problem of reconstructing the Chinese, I just give the number that is where they occur in the list. So coming first to the area of sila or morality, and then these numbers, like 8 means this is the 8th nun in the list, 26 the 26th, etc. So we find that bhikkhunis are lauded and praised for being outstanding in relation to the following qualities: upholding the disciplinary rules without infection, keeping to 3 robes, wearing the robes in an orderly manner, not being ashamed of wearing rough robes, begging in order, begging among a range of people, begging alms without choosing between rich and poor, continuously sitting on a grass mat, always being in secluded, quiet places, delighting in empty and secluded places, always living out in the open, undertaking ascetic practices, and delighting in being in abundant cemeteries. So this shows various aspects of monastic conduct. Keeping to the 3 robes means that one just has 3 robes and not any extra robes. Begging in order means that when one goes begging along a road, one doesn't go like this house. Usually one gets good alms, but the next one not so good, so one passes by and just takes the one after, but one goes from each house to house. And begging alms without choosing between rich and poor has a similar implication, that one, because at a poor house, obviously the food one gets will not be of such good quality. Delighting. Living out in the open is one of the ascetic practices. And delighting in being in abundant cemeteries, this is a particularly challenging ascetic practice. So we have bhikkhunis outstanding for each of these types of conduct in the Ekottarika Agama. Now let us move on to the area of concentration. bhikkhunis outstanding in the area of concentration for having a mind that is not scattered, being doing all activities with a mind that does not stray, always being with unification of the mind, sitting alone without moving at all, sitting at the root of a tree with an unmoving mind, having a mind that is calm without agitated perceptions, dwelling much in benevolence and empathy, having compassion for living beings, cherishing patience, entering concentration on water, entering concentration on fire, having supernatural powers, recollecting past lives and possessing the divine eye. This again shows us bhikkhunis covering a whole range of qualities related to the development of samadhi, concentration or tranquility, samatha. We might find already the second one somewhat challenging, being doing all activities with the mind that does not stray. Always being with unification of the mind is also not particularly easy. Sitting alone without moving at all is a very helpful aspect of samatha practice. Benevolence, empathy and compassion brings in the Brahma Viharas. Concentration on water and fire, concentration on the elements, which in later tradition then leads on to the kasina type of practice. Supernatural powers are recognized in early Buddhism as available through deep concentration, and recollecting the past lives and the divine eye is one of the six higher knowledges to be attained through concentration, where one is able to recollect one's own past lives, or through the divine eye is able to see the passing away and re-arising of other beings. And now we come to wisdom. So, bhikkhunis are outstanding for being learned and kind, wise and intelligent, for widely discoursing on the teaching, contemplating the teachings with understanding, being liberated by faith, being not polluted by attachment, having acquired the four analytical knowledges, these are the patisambhidas, joyfully attaining the path, quickly accomplishing the fruits of the path, contemplating impurity and analyzing dependent arising, cultivating wishlessness, delighting in signlessness and in eradicating all attachments, keeping to emptiness, attaining final realization. Again, a whole range of abilities and attainments in the area of wisdom are being listed here, from being learned all the way up to final realization. And then there is this other aspect which I personally find quite important also, and which is, as I have argued in several papers, an integral aspect of the early Buddhist conception of the path, this aspect of compassion, empathy, of benefiting others. So here we have the qualities of supporting people, giving them what is lacking, composing stanzas in praise of the virtues of the Tathagata, discussing in various ways without hesitation, converting outsiders, establishing them in the right teaching, being respected and liked by the people, teaching and transforming people, delivering people without limits, widely teaching the development of the path, widely explaining and analyzing profound teachings. Now, when we look at all these qualities, what I think is to be kept in mind here also is that for one, bhikkhuni to be singled out as outstanding means that the whole range of bhikkhunis must have had this quality also, although to a lesser extent. You can only be outstanding if there is a possibility to compare yourself with others. So to say among bhikkhunis, this bhikkhuni is outstanding for such and such a quality, it means a whole group of bhikkhunis must have been having these qualities and attainments that we get in this listing. So taken together, this is, I think, excuse me, a very powerful presentation and recognition of the abilities of bhikkhunis in the Ekotarika Agama parallel to the Etaragavaga of the Anguttara Nikaya. And to conclude, I wanted to have another image to entertain you. This is taken from the Etaragavaga. It's a painting in Burma, and it shows the following four bhikkhunis. The actual painting is a little larger, but the bhikkhunis on the outer sides are less visible, and so I have taken only those in the middle which are visible. This is Uppalavanna. She is foremost for supernormal powers. Patachara, she is foremost for upholding the Vinaya. Dhammadinna, she is foremost in teaching the Dhamma. And Nanda, foremost in meditation. Sulamani Kupiaba in Myanmar, in Burma, painting of outstanding bhikkhunis. So that was all that I wanted to present, and we have a few more minutes for any questions or comments that you would like to make. We can also conclude at this point if there are no comments or questions. And maybe I could just try to summarize what I wanted to present. And the first part of my lecture, I was trying to show narrative strategies of distancing bhikkhunis and diminishing their abilities, particularly evident in the Nandakovada Sutta, in the Pali version, and where a closer study makes it safe to conclude that this is a later presentation. So the discourse being passed down to generations of all reciters, the negative attitude towards women in general, or bhikkhunis in particular, among these reciters would have led to a change in the presentation, making the whole group of Mahaprajapati Gautami and her followers appear in a more negative light. And this is a tendency particularly evident in the account of the foundation of the Order of Nuns, which we discussed last semester in the course on bhikkhuni ordination. But to balance this off, in the second part of the lecture, I took up one discourse from the Bhikshuni Samyukta and also the listing of outstanding bhikkhunis from Anguttara and Kotarika Agama to also show that there are passages where nuns are shown in a very positive light. And so combining this together, what we can see in the early Buddhist discourses is again this multivocality and these different attitudes, which I discussed briefly last year based on Alan Sponberg, where at times we find this soteriological inclusiveness, at other times this institutional androcentrism, and at times the ascetic misogyny. It's a question. I was late to the lecture, so I'm not sure whether this was discussed before, but why do we not find bhikkhunis like Patachara and Uppalavanna mentioned throughout the discourses to the same extent as Sariputta and Moggallana? Is this related to the lack of mention of the role of bhikkhunis in the first council? Yeah, I think, I mean, one, there's a several points here. One is that in the ancient Indian setting, nuns and monks being together could easily give rise to suspicions. In fact, the nuns in ancient India were considered by the general populace in the same class as prostitutes, because both were independent women that were not under the guardianship of husband, father, or son. And so for nuns to be seen in the company of males, particularly also of monks, could easily give suspicion that they were having some sort of amorous relationship. And because of that, the Buddha, when he was traveling around, was always followed by monks only. And there was very little interaction. And the nuns' order, from a relatively early stage on, seems to have been mainly based in urban locations. There's another thing also, that they needed protection. In fact, we have reports from the Jain order of nuns of different protective measures the nuns had to take in order to defend themselves against males who were trying to take advantage of them. And so there would, from the outset, have been less occasions for bhikkhunis to feature as the audience or protagonists of a discourse compared to bhikkhus, simply because of the setting itself making it much less improbable for them to be in such a situation. It would have been only predominantly when the Buddha was visiting one of these urban centers that they would have had a chance to interact with the Buddha. And this issue of urbanization is also relevant to the disappearance of the Bhikkhuni order in India in about, according to inscriptions, we reach up to the 8th century. And in my view, the most convincing explanation so far proposed for this disappearance is precisely the process of de-urbanization that we have in India starting from the 6th century, which would have deprived the Bhikkhunis of their economic foundation. Another aspect is that the transmission of the discourses was in the hand of monk reciters. And there is a increasingly negative attitude towards bhikkhunis, precisely beginning with the first sangiti that you mentioned. And so it would have been natural for them to take less interest in material that is related to bhikkhunis. In fact, the Tirugatha, a collection of poems by bhikkhunis, only exists in the Pali version. We have references to the Tirugatha in the Samyukta Agama and the Mula Savastivada Vinaya preserved in Tibetan, but we no longer have the collection. So another factor contributing to this situation would have been also the fact that the transmission of the text was dominated by males. And then the first Sangiti. The first Sangiti is a crucial, I would say, call it even a turning point in the attitude towards bhikkhunis. Because at this point the Buddha has passed away, and we can see in the different versions of the first Sangiti concording towards presenting Mahakashyapa as the emblem of the type of approach to monasticism to be followed from now, and Ananda being sort of pushed out of the picture. And Ananda, in the discourses in general, stands for a more accommodating attitude towards women. He is very close to the Buddha, he knows all the suttas, and he's always like, he's a more, almost I would say, a more feminine type as a monk. Whereas Mahakasyapa is a Brahmin by birth, and he is a strict upholder of asceticism. So the first Sangiti, the report of the narrative of the first Sangiti, shows a shift towards values held in the ancient Indian environment, Brahminical notions, and the affirmation of asceticism. And asceticism in the ancient Indian context is often defines its value by the distance it keeps from anything female. And this then eventually leads to this ascetic misogyny, this outburst of ascetic misogyny. And so this shift in perspective would have led also to an increasing unease towards bhikkhunis. Because from a Brahminical perspective, independent women, as I said earlier, are just on the same level as prostitutes. And a woman has her place in the household, where she should be the dutiful wife and the child-bearing mother. And in this situation, I believe that there's also a shift towards like wanting to keep the nuns under control and wanting to diminish their role and their value and their attainments. This is as far as I'm able to reconstruct the situation. And good that you asked this. This was not being discussed before, but this is an important aspect, yeah. I see some more questions are coming up, so good. I'll wait a little bit. Yeah, this the first Sangita is of particular importance for understanding the emergence of ascetic misogyny that we even find in some early suttas, and that is clearly evident in several accounts of the foundation of the Order of Nuns, and is such a prevalent, a recurrent feature also in later tradition. And it shows this shift of attitude motivated by the wish to preserve tradition in order to get support, of course, and thereby going down to values in the ancient Indian settings that were not really in accordance with what the earliest stage of the teachings were about. I think at this point we can come to a conclusion. So, can I ask a logistical aside? How will we link the question answer when we are replaying this lesson? Sorry if it is an elementary question. Yeah, I'm not sure I understand that. I usually read the questions and then give the answers. So, I think if the chat is sometimes not really in time with the recording, you could simply listen to what I say. And the last discourse presented, one of the virtues of bhikkhunis is the composition of stanzas. Could they tell us about the gradual compilation of the Therigathas? Yeah, but I would think that this is not specific for Therigatha. We would also have composition of stanzas by monks, and these we have in the Theragatha. And of the Theragatha, we have parallels preserved. Also, is the recitation of the Patimokkha absent as one of the virtues? Would that show anything about condition of the Vinaya recitation practice among the bhikkhunis in ancient India? Thank you again for the lecture. No, I think we had Patachara here. We have Patachara for upholding the Vinaya. And the Patimokkha was also being recited by the bhikkhunis. What we do have is that the extant versions of the Patimokkha, of the code of rule for bhikkhunis, show greater variations between the different Buddhist schools than in the case of the Patimokkha of the bhikkhus. Good, then we conclude at this point. Thank you very much for your attention, and I look forward together with all of you to the lectures that will be given by all my colleagues. We have a very beautiful and powerful list of international scholars who will be presenting various aspects, and I really look forward together with all of you to learn from what they will be able to offer us. Thank you, and see you next week.